Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis or really even just trying to understand how our physical bodies work, there's this underlying expectation of precision.
Oh, absolutely. Like
Yeah.
you expect a clear answer.
Right. It's sort of like reverse engineering a car. You fall out of a tree, you break your arm, and the X-ray shows that jagged white line on the bone.
Yeah, on the radius or whatever.
Exactly. And the doctor just points right at it and says, "There it is. There is the exact problem."
Right, because it's fundamentally binary at that level. The bone is intact or it is fractured.
Yeah, the artery is clear or it is blocked. It's
Exactly.
clean, it's objective, and, well, quite frankly, it's incredibly comforting. We deeply crave for things to be visible like that.
We want our problems perfectly categorized so we can just, apply a mechanical fix.
But then you step into the world of human emotion. You step into neurodevelopment or trauma, or even just trying to explain why you woke up on a random Tuesday feeling this completely inexplicable, heavy sense of dread.
And suddenly, that beautiful, precise X-ray machine is just completely useless.
Totally useless. We're looking at a landscape of feelings that is, I mean, murky is a huge understatement.
Yeah, and modern science, for all its absolute brilliance, it tends to treat our subjective emotions like this fuzzy, unscientific byproduct of the brain.
Like exhaust coming out of an engine. It's there, it smells, but it's not the actual engine itself.
Right. And meanwhile, philosophy has been struggling for, well, centuries to ground our feelings in any sort of hard, rigorous logic.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today we are taking a deep dive into a framework that completely shatters that old dynamic.
It really does.
We're looking at a genuinely mind-bending 2026 white paper by Dr. Bechara Sehli, and it's titled Emotional Sentience as Relational Architecture.
It is a staggering piece of work, honestly. What Dr. Sehli has done here is just monumental.
Yeah, I mean, it's dense, but it's incredible.
Very dense. He draws really heavily on the biological and philosophical models of Catherine Pell Kaufman, and he builds this bridge across a chasm that science usually just avoids entirely.
Right. On one side of this bridge, you have the messy, subjective, lived biology of human feeling, the stuff we all experience every single day.
Exactly. And on the other side, you have some of the most complex, beautiful, and rigorous mathematics in the known universe.
Which is,
Specifically, these things called exceptional Lie algebras.
which I will admit sounds incredibly intimidating to me.
Oh, it terrifies most people.
When I first read the phrase exceptional Lie algebras, my brain immediately wanted to power down, just completely shut off.
That is a very normal reaction.
But our mission today is to give you, the listener, a massive aha moment. We are definitely not just going to read you math equations.
No, please don't.
We are going to show you how these two seemingly opposite worlds, your messy feelings and this pristine math, actually map perfectly onto each other.
And the goal here is to help you realize that your emotions aren't just these fleeting moods. They aren't errors in your cognitive software.
Right, they actually have a fundamental geometry and an algebra to them.
Yes, they are the literal architecture of how you interact with reality.
And if you're listening to this right now and thinking, why on earth do I need to know the mathematics of my feelings?
I want you to think about every time you've ever felt completely overwhelmed by your emotions. Just entirely flooded.
Oh, yeah. Like, think about every time you've tried to logic your way out of a problem.
Like a relationship issue or a massive career panic.
Exactly. Only to find that pure logic simply cannot solve it.
Right. This deep dive is going to show you that your feelings are actually an ancient, highly structured sensory system.
They're designed to help you navigate space, time, and your very sense of self.
They really aren't the exhaust of the engine. They are the steering wheel.
I love that. So, to start this journey, we have to look at the first conceptual ladder that's presented in the white paper.
Right, the biological one.
Yeah, this is Catherine Pell Kaufman's Ascent of Emotional Sentience. And the core premise here completely flips the script on how we view the human mind.
It does. The paper argues that emotion is an ancient self-regulatory sensory system. It is the core biological software of life.
And that is such a crucial starting point. We really need to linger on it for a second.
Because it fights against literally hundreds of years of cultural programming. I mean, since the Enlightenment, right?
Since Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am."
Exactly. We've elevated rational thought to the absolute top of the hierarchy.
Ah.
And we typically think of emotions as something that happens to us.
Like a weather pattern or something.
Yeah, like a storm disrupting the rational functioning of our minds. We say things like, oh, my emotions clouded my judgment.
Right, as if the judgment is the pure thing and the emotion is the dirt on the windshield.
But Kaufman argues that emotion is biologically primary. If you look at an organism, like literally any organism, even going all the way back to single-celled life,
it has to know what's good for it.
Yes. It needs to know what supports its viability and what threatens it. So pleasure and pain, at their most primitive evolutionary levels, they aren't just arbitrary sensations.
They are coarse-grained indicators, right? They aren't just a luxury of higher-order brains with a cerebral cortex.
Exactly. They are evaluative signals. Pain is just the organism's way of saying, hey, move away from this. It's dangerous to our structural integrity.
And pleasure is saying, move toward this. It's good for our survival.
Yes, and that is a sensory system. It is taking in data from the environment, evaluating its meaning to the organism, and then driving a physical response.
And the source text mentions how emotion is deeply tied to our endocrine, immune, and autonomic systems.
It's completely hardwired into what they call the action-perception loop.
Right, and this leads to a massive shift in cognitive science that the paper discusses. A lot of people listening might be vaguely familiar with the concept of 4E cognition.
Yeah, it's been a pretty big buzzword in psychology for a while now.
The 4Es: embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended. Let me see if I can break those down quickly before we get to Kaufman's twist.
Go for it.
Okay, so embodied means our mind isn't just a brain in a jar, right? It requires a physical body to actually think.
Right. The body is part of the thinking process.
Then embedded means the mind is situated in a physical and social environment that actively shapes it.
Makes sense.
Enacted means cognition emerges through active interaction with the world. Like, we literally think by doing things.
Yeah, moving through space.
And extended means our tools, like our smartphones or even just the simple notepad, they literally become part of our cognitive process.
Right, you offload your memory onto the paper.
Exactly. So that's 4E cognition. Mm. The Kaufman introduces 5E cognition. She adds a 5th E, which is the emotive mind.
And she says it's foundational to all the other 4Es.
Because you cannot separate cognition from affect.
You literally cannot have a thought that isn't underwritten by some sort of biological value system. It's impossible.
Wow. And to really understand this paradigm shift, we have to look at how she splits human awareness into what she calls the dual streams.
This is where the framework gets incredibly practical for daily life. So in one stream, you have thought.
Okay.
Thought is syntactic. It's predictive. It's linguistic. It operates on rules and grammar. And it's all about explicit conceptual processing.
It's the literal voice in your head forming full sentences.
Exactly. And in the other stream, you have feeling.
And feeling is semantic.
Yes. Feeling carries the actual meaning. It's fully embodied. It's deeply self-relevant. And it is the motive force for immediate action.
So if I'm navigating my life, is thought kind of like the GPS on my dashboard?
Okay, Alexis.
Like, it's giving me explicit syntactic turn-by-turn directions. In 500 feet, turn left.
Right.
But feeling is the actual steering wheel and the engine, like the semantic drive that actually makes the car move and decides if that destination even matters to me at all.
What's fascinating here is that your analogy perfectly illustrates why what Kaufman calls the subjective observer is physically significant.
Okay, explain that.
Well, traditional science usually tries to strip the subjective observer out of the equation entirely.
Right, to be objective.
We are taught that to find objective truth, we have to remove human bias. We have to remove the I from the experiment.
So take the driver out of the car.
But going back to your car analogy, you can't strip the engine, the steering wheel, and the driver out of the car and still expect it to navigate the road.
Right, it's just a metal box sitting there.
Exactly. The inward perspective, the actual frame of reference of the entity doing the feeling, is central to the creative machinery of reality.
You cannot describe a lived reality without including the subject doing the living.
Exactly.
And to back that up, the paper dives into the concepts of distinction and self-reference, and it draws really heavily on George Spencer Brown's book, Laws of Form.
Yes. Very famous text in certain math and logic circles.
Now, I had to read this section a few times because it sounds super abstract at first, but it essentially says that the creative act of making a distinction, like drawing a line in the sand, doesn't just separate a foreground from a background.
Let's visualize that for the listener. Mm-hmm. Imagine you have a completely blank, infinite sheet of paper.
Okay, totally blank.
There is nothing there, no meaning, no structure at all. But the moment you draw a single closed circle on that paper, you haven't just drawn a shape.
You've birthed an entire architecture.
Yes. By creating a boundary, you have simultaneously created an inside and an outside.
Oh, wow. You've created a bounded identity and its environment at the exact same time.
Exactly. You cannot have the concept of an environment without an identity to experience it, and vice versa. They co-arise.
So when a primitive biological cell forms, like a lipid membrane, it is essentially drawing Spencer Brown's circle.
It is separating self from not self. And this requires a completely different kind of logic than the flat, binary, either the dualism we are so used to in Western thought.
Right. We love to separate mind and body. We separate subject and object, thought and feeling.
But Kaufman invokes this idea of dyoic complementarity to explain this fundamental biological reality.
Like yin and yang in ancient Chinese philosophy.
Precisely. They are opposites, sure, but they actually require one another to exist.
You can't have the concept of shadow without the concept of light.
Right. It's a both-and logic rather than an either-or logic. Light and dark, chaos and order, thought and feeling.
So understanding reality requires not just looking at one pole or the other, but looking at the living relation between them.
Yes. And applying this both-and logic completely redefines how we view information itself.
That part was genuinely fascinating to me, because when we hear the word information today, we immediately think of computers.
Right. We think of ones and zeros.
Exactly.
We think of Claude Shannon. Shannon is basically the father of information theory.
Right.
In 1948, he published a mathematical theory of communication that literally gave us the digital age.
But Shannon's information is purely syntactic, right?
Completely. It's only about how many bits you need to transmit a message across a noisy channel without errors. It does not care what the message actually means.
Right. A string of binary code that tells a computer to launch a nuclear missile is mathematically identical to a string of binary code that tells a screen to display a picture of a cat.
As long as the file size is the same, Shannon's math treats them as identical.
But biological information, like the feeling of terror or love or hunger, has to carry meaning. It can't just be neutral file sizes.
Which is why Kaufman bridges Shannon's syntactic information with Gregory Bateson's semantic information.
Okay, Bateson.
Bateson famously defined information as a difference, which makes a difference.
I love that phrase.
It's perfect. Okay. So Kaufman argues that biological information is both process and form.
Right. It's the active informing process, the verb, the doing, the evaluating, and the stabilized organization, the noun, the structure.
It's the difference that makes a difference to the organism.
Okay. I am entirely with you on the biology here. If emotion is this fundamental, deeply structured biological software, if it's a semantic, self-relevant sensory system operating on this dyoic complementarity, that makes perfect sense of my lived experience.
Yeah, it grounds what we feel every day.
But here is where the paper takes a massive, almost dizzying leap. How do we actually represent that formally?
Right.
Like you said, it can't just be Shannon's binary code. Ones and zeros aren't rich enough to capture the feeling of profound grief or a sudden rush of joy.
And that right there is exactly where the fracture in modern science lies. We haven't had a graded mathematical architecture capable of carrying the richness of lived embodied feeling.
Our math has basically been too flat.
Yes. Until we look at the second ladder in Dr. Safely's white paper, the relational exceptional formal program.
This is the math part. And to you listening, I really want to pause here and say, do not worry if you don't have a PhD in theoretical physics or advanced topology.
We are going to make this accessible.
We're going to walk through this conceptually, and I am going to be asking for analogies every single step of the way, because the paper derives this mathematical ladder from something called the Freudenthal-Titz magic square and normed division algebras.
Whoa. Yeah.
I mean, just the names are a mouthful.
They really are. But let's strip away the intimidating terminology. What mathematicians like Hans Freudenthal and Jacques Titz were doing in the mid-20th century was looking for the ultimate structures of symmetry in the universe.
Okay.
They were exploring how different algebraic systems lock together. And Scioli takes this work and organizes it into an ascent.
A ladder.
A ladder of mathematical complexity that perfectly mirrors Kaufman's biological ladder of emotion. Let's just climb it step by step.
Okay, let's do it.
The first rung on this mathematical ladder addresses the problem of lawful closure.
Lawful closure, meaning how do things group together to form a complete system?
Exactly. If binary dyads, like simple opposites like 1 and 0 or on and off, aren't rich enough to model human emotion, what is the absolute minimum structure we need?
And the paper introduces the Fano plane here.
Right.
Okay. I have absolutely no idea what a Fano plane is. The paper called it the smallest projective plane. 7 points, 7 lines. But what does that actually mean?
How does that relate to your feelings?
Exactly.
Think of it as the most basic grammar of meaning. Imagine you have a system of elements, and you want them to interact, but you don't want them to just be isolated pairs.
Okay.
The Fano plane is a beautiful little geometric structure where you have 7 points and 7 lines, arranged so that every line contains exactly 3 points and every point is on exactly 3 lines.
So it's heavily interconnected.
Deeply interconnected. It shows how a finite set of elements can belong to one closed, stable whole. Not just through exhaustive pairs, but through privileged triadic relations.
3 things relating all at once.
Yes. It gives us a skeleton for a field of meaning that is infinitely richer than just a simple binary switch.
Wait, I see it. If primitive biology is making a distinction between me and the environment and the value of the environment, that's a triad right there.
Exactly. The Fano plane provides the mathematical grammar for that exact relationship.
Okay, I can visualize that. A network of 7 interconnected nodes that form a stable system. But then we step up to the second rung, and the math gets a lot stranger.
The octonion.
Yeah. The paper says this is an 8-dimensional algebra. And the key thing it highlights is that in octonionic multiplication, the math is non-commutative and non-associative.
Right. Let's break that down.
Well, I remember the commutative property from middle school math, right? 2 times 3 is the same as 3 times 2. Both equal 6. Order doesn't matter.
Right. But in our reality, order almost always matters. Putting on your socks and then your shoes yields a very different result than putting on your shoes and then your socks.
Wow, that's a great way to put it.
That is non-commutative.
Right.
A times B is not the same as B times A. Now, quaternions, which are a 4-dimensional algebra, are non-commutative. But octonions go a step further.
Right. They're also non-associative. What does non-associative mean?
It's all about grouping. In normal math, if you have A plus B plus C, you can group A and B together first, or B and C together first, and the answer is the exact same.
Like 1 plus 2 plus 3 is the same as 1 plus 2 plus 3.
Right. But in octonionic algebra, A times the group of B and C is not necessarily the same as the group of A and B times C.
Interesting.
The way elements are grouped and the specific sequence they are introduced changes the fundamental nature of the outcome. It is highly, highly context sensitive.
Wait, hold on. I have to stop you here.
Okay.
I am tracking with the math concepts. Socks and shoes, grouping matters, I get that. But we are jumping from human feelings, like the anxiety I feel before a job interview, to quantum level, 8-dimensional, non-associative algebra.
It's a big jump.
Aren't we mixing up our categories here? We're taking the biology of a sweating palm and smacking it into theoretical physics used to describe string theory.
It is a massive, audacious leap. And frankly, it's why this paper is so incredibly provocative. But Dr. Saley is very careful to clarify the methodological restraint of this framework.
Okay, what does he say?
This is what he calls a disciplined formal analogy. It is not a literal physical identity.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, the paper is absolutely not claiming that a feeling of sadness is literally a glowing 8-dimensional mathematical object floating in your chest.
Because that sounded like mysticism to me, not science. But if it's not literal, why use this specific, insanely complex math at all? Why drag octonions into psychology?
Because if human feelings are as complex, context-dependent, and irreducible as Kaufman's biology suggests they are, we desperately need a mathematical scaffold that actually respects that complexity.
Okay, that makes sense.
If you try to model human emotion using simple binary logic, or even standard commutative algebra, you flatten the emotion entirely. You destroy its very nature.
You lose the context.
Exactly. The math of the relational exceptional ladder shows what is formally required to preserve the richness of the biology. If psychology is going to be a hard science, it needs a mathematics of context and sequence.
Oh, I see.
Octonians provide the formal proof that a structured system can be inherently context-sensitive and non-associative.
Got it. So the math isn't the emotion, it's the scaffolding that proves a structure can exist for something this complex.
Right.
Like if we want to understand an incredibly complex building, we need the blueprints of projective geometry, even if the building itself is made of bricks and glass, not literal pencil lines.
Exactly. We are looking for the structural logic.
Let's keep climbing then. After octonions, the paper introduces a concept called triality.
Triality is a special symmetry associated with a space called spin 8.
Okay.
Now, without getting bogged down in massive equations, what you need to know is that triality reveals something totally astonishing. In this specific eight-dimensional space, there are three irreducible representations of the structure.
They're called a vector, a spinor, and a conjugate spinor. You're going to have to translate that for me. What is a vector and what on earth is a spinor?
Sure. Think of a vector like an arrow. It has a length and a direction. It is manifest. It is public. It tells you exactly where something is pointing in space. It's what classical physics loves to deal with.
Right. Velocity, force, that kind of thing.
But a spinor is much stranger. It represents an internal rotational degree of freedom. Have you ever seen the Dirac belt trick or the Philippine wine dance?
I don't think so.
Okay, imagine holding a cup of coffee flat in your palm.
All right, I'm holding it.
If you rotate your arm 360 degrees without dropping the cup, your arm ends up all twisted.
Yeah, it would be twisted backwards.
Well, get your arm back to its original untwisted state, you actually have to rotate the cup another 360 degrees.
Wait, really?
Yes. It takes a 720-degree rotation, two full turns, to actually return to the true starting state. That is the absolute essence of a spinor.
That is wild. So it has this hidden internal twisting.
Yes. It has an intrinsic, hidden, generative interiority that classical vectors just don't capture.
Okay, I think I get the difference.
Now, what triality proves is that in spinsate, the vector, the spinor, and the conjugate spinor are perfectly symmetrical.
Wait, so the public arrow and the hidden twist are mathematically equal?
Yes, they are mathematically equivalent, yet deeply irreducibly distinct. It proves that one underlying structure can have multiple co-fundamental modes of presentation.
The outside vector and the inside spinor are equal partners.
Exactly. None of them can be reduced to the other.
Which perfectly maps onto the mind-body problem. Like, it mirrors the idea that the inside of our experience, our subjective feeling, and the outside of our physical bodies can exist at the exact same time.
Right.
From the same underlying structure without one just being a fake illusion of the other. The mind isn't a ghost in the machine, and the body isn't just a meat robot. They are triality in action.
Exactly. It gives mathematical legitimacy to the subjective inner life. It's huge.
Wow.
From triality, the latter moves up to what's called the Albert algebra and the Frodenthal triple system, or FTS.
How does that elevate the structure? Like, what's the next step?
This is where we move from just looking at oriented relations into structured state spaces and transformational phase spaces.
Let's break that down.
The Albert algebra allows us to look at an integrated structured whole where some aspects are explicitly manifest and others are hidden but actively shaping the relations.
So it's like a geometry of relationships.
Exactly. It's a geometry. And FTS allows us to map transformations over time. It shows how a state holds its present reality, its latent alternatives, and its future anticipations all at the exact same moment.
And finally, we reach the top of the ladder, E7 and E8.
E7 introduces something called a quartic invariant.
Okay.
It is a mathematical measure of whole system coherence. It essentially asks, is this entire complex system hanging together or is it breaking apart?
Got it.
And E8 functions as the ultimate symbolic horizon of total perfected relational order, the highest possible symmetry.
Okay, so we have these two completely different ladders. We have Kaufman's biological semantic ascent of emotional sentience, starting from single cells making primitive distinctions. And we have Saley's mathematical, relational, exceptional ascent of formal structure, moving from the 7-point Fano plane all the way up to the mind-bending symmetries of E8.
Yes.
So how do these two ladders actually lock together? How do they illuminate each other in a way that explains my daily experience? Because the white paper lays out a beautiful 4-step roadmap to bridge them.
It does.
It's grammar, algebra, geometry, and dynamics.
This 4-fold roadmap is where the abstract theory hits the visceral reality of your lived experience.
Okay, let's go.
It reorganizes emotional sentience, not as a random list of feeling states, but as a multi-level relational architecture. Let's start at the base level, which is grammar.
In the mathematical ladder, this was the Fano plane, right? Primitive lawful closure.
Exactly. But apply to our biology, grammar is where emotional feeling begins as primitive relevance discrimination.
Okay, so the organism evaluating what is good or bad for it.
Right. It is the most basic distinction of significance.
Yeah.
Imagine an amoeba sensing a toxin in the water.
Does this environment invite approach or does it call for withdrawal?
Exactly. It's not just a neutral observation of chemical gradients. The value, the relevance to the organism's survival is literally baked into the distinction itself.
That is the grammar of emotion, the foundational alphabet of meaning.
Beautifully put, yes.
Then we move to the second level, which is algebra. In the math, this is the Octonians, where sequence and grouping matter because they are non-commutative and non-associative.
Right.
And applied to human emotion, this is the composition of meaning. And here's where it gets really interesting to me. If emotions are algebraic in an octonionic way, it's a lot like baking.
Oh, I love this. Explain that.
Well, the ingredients are the exact same, but the order you put them in changes the entire reality of the cake.
Right.
You do flour, then eggs, then bake, then frost, and you get a cake.
Yes.
But if you bake the flour, throw raw eggs on it, and then add frosting, you get a disaster.
Yes.
Translated to emotions, feeling fear after you recognize a friendly face is a totally different lived reality than recognizing a friendly face after you feel fear.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this totally upends flat syntactic information theory.
How so?
Emotional meaning isn't just a simple sum of isolated parts. A memory, a bodily cue, an environmental signal. They don't just add up 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 3.
Right, because of the grouping.
Because human sentience is an octonionic-like algebra, the sequence alters the meaning of the whole. Let me give you a really profound psychological example.
Please do.
Shame experienced in the presence of trusted care creates a totally different semantic meaning than shame experienced in the presence of an active threat.
Oh, wow. Yes.
In the first sequence, you have shame, then trusted care. The grouping creates a pathway for vulnerability and deep relational bonding. It builds trust.
But in the second sequence.
In the second sequence, shame, then threat, the grouping creates trauma and deep alienation.
The ingredients are similar, but the algebraic sequence literally changes the felt world.
Exactly.
That is profound. It completely validates why our complex, messy, seemingly irrational emotional reactions are so hard to untangle.
They aren't irrational at all.
No. They actually follow a highly sophisticated logic of composition, a logic that traditional psychology often just misses entirely because it's looking for linear cause and effect.
Right. From algebra, we move to geometry.
Okay, the third level.
The math here is the Albert algebra, the structured state spaces we talked about. Biologically, the paper calls this the disclosure of the world state.
Disclosure of the world state. This is a crucial pivot in the framework, isn't it?
It really is. We usually think of a feeling as an inner tone, like a private color wash playing on a screen inside your head.
Right.
But the paper argues that feeling actually configures a world. It projects salience.
What does that mean exactly, projects salience?
Think about walking down a city street at night. If you were in a state of deep peace and contentment, the geometry of your world looks a certain way.
The shadows are just shadows.
Right. The strangers are just background scenery. The affordances, the opportunities for action are wide open.
Okay, I picture that.
But if you suddenly hear footsteps running up behind you and you enter a state of terror, the geometry of your world literally changes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The shadows become hiding places or threats.
The alleyway becomes an escape route or a trap. Your visual field narrows. Your body, your environment, and the significance of that environment all configure into one structured geometric state.
This is what the paper calls the organism world effect configuration.
Yes.
The feeling is literally the lens through which the geometry of the world is drawn. The world doesn't just sit there objectively while I feel scared. My fear redraws the lines of the world.
Exactly. And finally, the fourth level, dynamics.
Right. In math, this is the Freudenthal triple system and the E7 invariant, the transformational phase space and whole system coherence.
In our lived experience, this is transformation through time.
Because feelings are not static snapshots, right? We aren't cameras.
Exactly. Sentience includes memory, anticipation, habit, and developmental history. We don't just have a present isolated feeling. We inhabit a continuous affective trajectory.
So dynamics is where we hold the present reality alongside the latent alternatives.
It's the lived registration of whether your whole life system is integrating, growing, and harmonizing, or whether it is disintegrating under stress.
Okay, so let's summarize the roadmap. We have grammar distinguishing basic relevance. We have algebra composing complex meaning through sequence.
Right.
We have geometry disclosing the actual state of the world we see. And we have dynamics transforming that world through time.
It's a brilliantly comprehensive architecture.
It really is. But I have a glaring question here. And it's a question that always trips up neuroscientists.
Hit me.
Now that we understand the structure of the world we are perceiving, where does the self, the you that is listening to this right now, the I that is speaking, actually sit inside this geometry?
That is the million-dollar question.
Right, because historically, science has a really hard time explaining where the subjective I comes from. They can point to the brain regions firing, but they can't find the conductor of the orchestra.
This is undoubtedly one of the most difficult and decisive parts of Saheeli synthesis.
So how does he solve it?
To understand the self in this framework, we have to look closely at triality again, and something called the topology of intrinsic freedom.
Okay, let's bring back that math term, triality. We talked about vectors and spinors.
Right. The paper maps this to irreducible interiority.
You have the vector, which represents the manifest relation, the exterior, structured, describable world.
And then you have the spinor, which represents generative interiority.
And the conjugate spinor, which represents reflexive or complementary interiority.
The profound takeaway from triality, as we touched on earlier, is that a relational whole can have multiple fundamental modes of presentation that do not collapse into one another.
Objective science loves the vector mode. It loves what is measurable, public, directional, and objective.
But lived reality also presents itself through inward, generative, reflexive modes. Your inner voice, your felt sense of me.
And triality provides a formal, rigorous mathematical image proving that these interior modes can be just as fundamental as the exterior ones.
Exactly. You do not have to explain away your subjective self as an illusion to be scientifically rigorous.
The eye is baked into the math of the universe.
It is. And the paper enriches this by bringing in the physicist Arthur Eddington's concept of phase.
Now, when we think of where things are, we usually think of a 3D Cartesian coordinate system, x, y, z, height, width, depth.
But Eddington's phase is an intrinsic orientational degree of freedom.
Let me try to visualize that. A coordinate tells you where a dot is on a map.
Right, but phase tells you the internal timing, the angle, the lead lag of that dot. It's an internal freedom carried by every single point.
Imagine a pendulum swinging. Its coordinate tells you its physical position at any given millisecond.
Yes, but its phase tells you where it is in its overall cycle of swinging back and forth.
Oh, I see. And once you admit that reality has this intrinsic orientational freedom, this phase, flat Cartesian space, is no longer enough.
Not at all. You need topological enrichments. The paper talks about several mind-bending shapes.
It mentions fiber bundles, where internal freedom is hosted over a base space.
And it talks about Möbius topology.
The Möbius strip is a great analogy.
It is. If you take a strip of paper, give it a half twist, and tape the ends together, you create a Möbius strip.
It models continuity across apparent duality.
Right. It looks like it has two sides, an inside and an outside. But if you trace your finger along it, you realize it is one continuous path.
This is a perfect topological model for the intertwining of thought and feeling, or mind and body. They seem like two different surfaces, but they are continuous.
Exactly. And then it brings up the torus topology.
Right. A torus is essentially the shape of a donut or an inner tube. So what does this all mean for the listener?
Let's bring it back down to earth.
If I'm understanding the torus topology correctly, is the self essentially like a whirlpool in a river?
Oh, that's good.
Like it has a bounded identity, it has local closure, you can point to it and say, there is the whirlpool.
But it is entirely connected to and literally made of the river itself.
Yes.
This raises an important question, and your whirlpool analogy is excellent. Subjectivity is not a private spectator locked inside a Cartesian theater, watching an objective movie of the world through the windows of your eyes.
Right, that is the old model.
In this new framework, the self is a local reflexive closure within a multiply connected whole.
And the torus perfectly models this. Localized distinctness without severance.
Exactly. The water in the whirlpool is constantly flowing in from the river and out into the river, yet the pattern of the whirlpool persists.
You are distinct, but you are not severed from the architecture of reality. You are a local folding of the universe experiencing itself.
Which brings us to the ultimate triadic horizon of Kaufman's biological ascent. Completely redefined by the exceptional math we've just discussed.
Space, time, and self.
Usually we think of space, time, and the self as three independent, pre-given containers.
Right.
Space is the empty stage, time is the clock ticking on the wall, and the self is the actor walking onto the stage. But the paper argues forcefully that they are not independent. They are mutually implicating aspects of one single relational architecture.
Let's break that down, because this is where the philosophy becomes incredibly practical.
Okay.
Space is not just empty extension, like an empty box waiting to be filled. It is structured differentiation. It is an articulated world state, a field of salience, like we talked about with the dark alleyway.
And time is not just homogeneous linear succession. Tick-tock, mm-hmm. Tick-tock.
Right.
It is phase, history, anticipation, and transformation. It is tied to functional information.
Time feels different when you are in a car crash versus when you are waiting in line at the DMV, because time is a structural component of your sentient architecture, not just a universal clock ticking in the background.
The paper calls this a second arrow of time, one that points toward meaning and integration.
And the self is not an isolated substance, but that local reflexive closure we just talked about, the whirlpool. Okay, so this basically blows up the classic Cartesian theater entirely. If I feel a sudden wave of grief or a burst of joy, that's not just a private movie playing inside my head while the universe ticks on indifferently outside.
Exactly. Emotional sentience is one of the primary sites where space, time, and self are coordinated in lived experience.
So when you feel a profound emotion, you are not just registering a local chemical fluctuation in a gray blob inside your skull.
No, you are experiencing an event in the coordination of reality itself.
Feeling configures the space of your world, it draws on the history and anticipation of time, and it centers the reflexive closure of the self.
Emotions are the literal altimeter for our reality. They are the readout of how space, time, and self are aligning.
But if our emotions are this vital structural system, this mathematical geometry, what happens when the math doesn't balance? What are the real-world implications when the system breaks down? Because the paper goes into significant depth about medicine, psychiatry, and society.
It does. And this is where that E7 quartic invariant we briefly mentioned becomes so conceptually useful.
Wait, you glossed over that earlier. What exactly is an invariant in simple terms?
Good catch. In mathematics, an invariant is a property of a system that remains completely unchanged even when you apply transformations to the system.
Think of the center of gravity of a spinning object. The object is moving wildly, but the center of gravity holds invariant.
Exactly. In the E7 math, the quartic invariant is a complex polynomial that measures the deep entanglement and integrity of the whole system.
So at the biological dynamic level, feeling is the lived registration of this whole system coherence.
Yes. When your system is mathematically and biologically coherent, when the invariant is positive, the lived registration is resonance, peace, clarity, and vitality.
The engine is humming smoothly. The geometry is stable.
Yes. But the paper maps out the stages of what happens when that coherence starts to slip. It goes from coherence to strain.
Strain. I think everyone listening knows what that feels like.
Strain is transitional stress. It's a loss of margin, rising tension, anxious vigilance.
The relational couplings, how your space, time, and self are interacting with the world, are becoming unstable.
Right. You are burning energy just to maintain the shape of your reality.
And if the stream isn't resolved, if the invariant drops further, it leads to fragmentation.
Fragmentation is whole system breakdown. This is where you move from anxiety into dread, alienation, and dissociation.
The disclosure of the world collapses. The geometry shatters.
The system fails to integrate its present state with its latent alternatives. You feel stuck, trapped, or completely detached from reality.
But there is a path back, right? Reintegration.
Yes. Reintegration is the movement back toward coherence. Relief, reorientation, recovery, and renewed agency.
So when we look at the clinical and psychiatric implications of this framework, it is completely revolutionary.
It means that psychiatric dysregulation, like severe depression or trauma, isn't just a chemical imbalance in a modular part of the brain.
You can't just isolate the serotonin receptor and say, there is the broken bone.
No, it is a cross-level mismatch. It's a faulty coordination across the grammar, algebra, geometry, and dynamics of the person's entire relational architecture.
Which means our entire approach to healing and therapy has to change.
Right.
If I'm hearing this right, therapy cannot just be swapping out a bad cognitive belief for a good one, like updating a line of code.
And it can't just be dampening a symptom with a pill to numb the exhaust.
Are you saying cognitive behavioral therapy or medication doesn't work?
No, not at all.
No, I'm saying that when therapy does work, it's not because it's just swapping code. It works because it is practically trying to rebuild the projective geometry of how a person's world is drawn and navigated.
That is a brilliant way to put it, yes.
Thank you.
A good therapist might be working on the grammar level, helping a traumatized patient alter primitive distinctions of salience and safety.
Helping them realize that the current environment is actually safe. Changing the basic relevance tag.
Or they might be working on the algebraic level, changing how effect-laden memories are sequenced and grouped to create new meaning.
So therapy is really a multi-level reorganization of sentient architecture.
Yes. And the E7 invariant conceptual clue proves that modular, reductive theories of emotion, treating feelings as isolated chemical drips in a vacuum, are just wildly inadequate We have to track the whole system integrity.
And what's truly terrifying, or perhaps illuminating, is that the paper scales this up to social and collective reality, too.
It doesn't just stop at the individual.
Social fear, mass resentment, trust, public humiliation, solidarity. These aren't just additive properties of a bunch of individuals feeling the same thing at the same time.
No, they are not. They are modes in which shared relational fields become collectively configured or collectively dysregulated.
We literally share a world geometry.
Yes. A cultural breakdown of meaning, like what we see during a political crisis or an economic collapse or a pandemic, is a literal misalignment in a shared architecture of sentience.
Wow. If we understand that emotions are world disclosing and geometric, then mass social fear, amplified by something like social media algorithms, literally changes the geometry of the collective world we inhabit together.
It narrows affordances for society as a whole.
It makes the collective world feel smaller, more dangerous, and more fragmented. We lose our shared whole system coherence.
And that is why treating social malaise requires more than just policy tweaks. It requires a restoration of collective trust.
A re-knitting of the relational algebra that allows us to group our shared experiences into meaning rather than trauma.
It makes complete sense when you look at it that way.
We have covered an incredible amount of ground today.
We really have.
We started with your everyday biological feelings, the pleasure of a warm cup of coffee, the pain of a stubbed toe, the anxiety of a deadline.
And we looked at Catherine Pell Kaufman's 5E cognition, showing how emotion is the ancient semantic software of life.
We saw how that biology required a logic of complementarity, not dualism. And then we took those biological demands and mapped them onto the exceptional mathematics of Dr. Safely's formal ladder.
We moved from the minimal sevenfold closure of the Fano plane up through the context-sensitive, non-associative algebra of Octonians.
We explored the irreducible modes of triality, proving your inner life is mathematically valid. We mapped the structured geometry of Albert spaces and finally reached the whole system coherence of E7 invariants.
And by walking through the roadmap of grammar, algebra, geometry, and dynamics, we discovered that emotions are not just noise in the machine.
They're the literal semantic geometry of our relational reality. They're the events that coordinate space, time, and self into a coherent existence.
It is a paradigm-shifting way to view our own humanity.
We are not just thinking machines that happen to feel. We are feeling architectures that disclose worlds.
Very well said.
Now, before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over, a little thread that builds on everything we've discussed today.
Okay, I'm ready.
We've spent this entire deep dive establishing that human emotion is the necessary algebra and geometry required to process semantic meaning and actually navigate space and time. So what does that mean for artificial intelligence?
That is the multi-trillion dollar question, isn't it?
Exactly. We are currently pouring billions upon billions of dollars into trying to build artificial general intelligence. And we're doing it using purely syntactic, flat, binary information models.
LLMs predicting the next token.
Syntactic engines. Right. Based on everything we've unpacked today from Kaufman and Sajali, is it even physically or mathematically possible to create a truly smart mind if it completely lacks the structural geometry of feeling? Can you build a mind without the steering wheel?
It's a question that challenges the very foundations of how we are approaching the future of technology.
We really does.
If feeling... If the emotive fifth E is a prerequisite for world disclosure and semantic meaning, then a purely syntactic AI might process data endlessly and mimic human language perfectly, but it will never actually inhabit a world.
Right. It has no biological relevance, no primitive grammar of pain or pleasure, and therefore no real meaning.
Something to think about the next time you interact with a chatbot and wonder if there's anyone home inside the machine.
Without the geometry of feeling, there is no inside to speak of. Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today.
Yes, thank you for listening.
We hope this empowers you to view your next passing emotion not as a distraction or a malfunction or a fuzzy diagnostic mystery.
Instead of looking for a clean binary X-ray of your feelings, remember that your emotions are the universe actively configuring itself,
navigating its own beautiful, complex geometry right through you,